for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Lawmakers are coming down to the wire on a debt ceiling deficit deal. The president picked former Ohio Attorney General Cordray to head the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and the FEC ruled the Edwards presidential campaign must repay the government more than $2 million. Joining me for the domestic hour of our Friday news roundup, Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, and Reed Wilson of National Journal Hotline. You're invited to join us throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Morning.
How far apart or how close are we to a deal on this federal budget and the deficit and raising the debt ceiling, Naftali?
Well, I guess we have to be relatively close because in 11 days, the government's no longer going to be able to pay its bills. The thing that's emerged the most recently is that John Boehner and President Obama have been talking all this time about what they call a big deal or a grand deal that would close the deficit by something like $4 trillion, perhaps $3 trillion of it in spending cuts and $1 trillion in tax increases. But the details remain very fuzzy. There's still great disagreement on both sides. In fact, both sides are denying that they're anywhere close to a deal. And the dynamic we've seen recently is that every time something bubbles up, it's immediately shot down by people on one side or the other.
Why is that happening?
Well, you know, the stakes are very high here, and people have very strong feelings about this stuff. You know, we're talking about how we're going to handle the nation's finances for the next decade. There's a group of Republican freshmen in the House that are absolutely dead set against any tax increases, revenue increases of any kind at any time. And on the other side, Democrats are really starting to worry, as we saw in a fairly tempestuous meeting of Senate Democrats yesterday. They're starting to worry about Social Security and Medicare being cut without any commensurate increases in revenue. So tempers are getting short. You know, temperatures are hot in Washington, and the rhetoric is inflammatory, and it's just a really kind of a bad atmosphere in Congress right now.
Cheryl.
Yes, you know, this is going to be very painful for both sides, right? Democrats do not want cuts in entitlement programs like Medicare and Social Security.
But they're talking about such small cuts.
That's true. But Democrats were hoping to campaign in 2012 by asserting that Republicans were the party of cutting Medicare and Social Security. Now, faced with this grand bargain, if it goes through, they will be led by a president of their own party who wants to bring them along to doing the very thing that they campaigned against doing. And on the other side, Republican freshmen, the ones that Naftali referred to, came to Washington saying, no new spending, and we're not going to raise this debt ceiling. We're going to cut spending, and we're not going to impose any tax increases, even if those tax increases are, you know, closing loopholes. So on their side, they're balking as well. And, you know, when Americans look at this, if this kind of grand bargain goes through, it could be very alarming. It could, for instance, eliminate the mortgage interest tax deduction, a very, very popular tax deduction.
On homes $500,000.
Right, but still, Americans who file their taxes are accustomed to getting this deduction, and, you know, everybody is going to be in pain at the end.
So Reed Wilson, President Obama, wrote an op-ed piece for this morning's USA Today, talking about why cuts are necessary. He said a number of steps must be taken right away, extending tax relief for middle-class families, putting construction workers back on the job, building roads and highways. Did he make the case for the grand bargain?
Well, I think both sides are what both sides are doing at the moment is sort of laying the foundation to get their own members to vote yes on whatever eventually comes out. President Obama has a significant amount of work to do with Senate Democrats, with House Democrats, to get them to accept what they don't want to accept. The meeting yesterday at which the idea of a grand bargain broke while Senate Democrats were meeting with Jack Lew, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, was described by one senator as volcanic. It was not
Barbara Mikulski.
Exactly. It was, and on the Republican side, the Republicans, John Boehner, who's negotiating this deal, has to get his own freshman to move off this position that they simply cannot vote for a debt ceiling increase at all, whether or not it comes with spending cuts. That was a little bit, we saw that a little bit in the cut, cap, and balance bill that went through the House, but there has to be a something larger to get to that the revenue increases. We have seen again and again and again these sort of presentations behind closed doors to House Republicans trying to sort of scare them off their position. Last week it was a slide-by-slide presentation, day-by-day, what the government will owe in early August if the debt ceiling isn't increased. And the message to freshmen was the problem gets really bad really fast. There is no getting around it. Just yesterday, a bunch of officials from ratings agencies came in and met with House Republicans and warned them what happens if the national debt gets... Well, we'll have to see. Yeah. Republican leaders, though, they're in this position in which they have to convince their own members to move off the position that those new members think they were elected to defend.
The big dime.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a little bit of a divergence of interest, I think, on both sides between party leaders and the party rank and file. President Obama, Speaker Boehner, they both really want this grand deal. They want it badly. I think they're thinking in part about the country, but they're also thinking about history and their legacy and how they want to present themselves.
And next year's election.
And next year's election, particularly, I think, in the case of President Obama. But the rank and file on both sides, they're very wedded to their party principles and what they see as fundamental things that their party stands for. They're also thinking about the next election. They don't want to face primaries. And I think a real wild card in all this is the House Republicans. Nobody knows what they're going to do. They don't feel the sort of loyalty or obligation to party leaders that we're used to seeing. There's two parts of this deal. One is having Obama and Boehner agree, and the second part is having them bring their own members along. And nobody knows how that second part's going to go. I don't even think Speaker Boehner and Eric Cantor know what the Republican freshmen are going to do.
Is anybody, or tell me who you think doing this kind of bargaining is truly thinking about the American people?
Look, I don't want to presume motive, but I will say this. I think that President Obama and John Boehner are more in keeping with where the American people are. It's fascinating to watch these two men. You know, they played golf together a few weeks ago. They've obviously forged a working relationship together. And if you look at the polls just out this week, you can see that the majority of Americans are right where John Boehner and Barack Obama are. The majority want to reduce the deficit through a combination of tax increases and spending. 58% in the Washington Post poll published the other day said their leaders were not doing enough to strike a deal. So obviously, the public wants the leaders to work harder at striking a deal. Fully 80% of the public dissatisfied or angry about the way the federal government is working. You know, a lot of people out there in America, I think, are tearing their hair out at Washington. It's the kind of behavior that parents of teenagers just go crazy over, right? Because they have a big problem and they leave it to the last minute and you're constantly saying, why can't you get this done on time? And that's what's happening here.
And Cheryl just stole the numbers that I was about to cite. But that same ABC poll shows just how angry people are with Washington, D.C. ABC Washington Post poll talks about 63% of Americans say they're going to look around for somebody else to vote for rather than their own member of Congress. Only 30% say they'll vote for their own member of Congress in next year's elections. I feel like there are a lot of parallels here to the 1992 elections, there were a lot of incumbents lost their seats. There wasn't a big giant shift as there was 2 years later in 1994 when the Republicans took over. But people were angry at Washington, D.C.
So putting aside the politics, what would it do if, in fact, the U.S. government were downgraded, Naftali?
Well, I mean, I think almost everybody agrees it would be a disaster, and the ripple effects would be enormous. I mean, we're seeing that a little bit because some states are now being warned that they may be downgraded simply because they're so reliant on the federal government. But, I mean, interest rates would go up for almost everybody. The stock market would go down. The ripple effects on businesses and governments across the country, I think, would be terrible. And if the government wasn't just downgraded but really stopped paying its bills, I think it would be cataclysmic. And that's what people are saying. But one of the dynamics you're seeing is that I think particularly on the part of the House freshmen, they're used to not trusting authority. They're sort of, it's almost like an inherent principle with them that they can't trust people who are elites. And so I think that that's one reason that it's been difficult for their party leaders to persuade them that this really would be a big deal if we defaulted on August 2nd. I do think that's changing a little bit, but it's part of the challenge.
There's another element. What's the likelihood of the Federal Aviation Administration shutting down tonight? Yeah.
Remember when we had that rash of air traffic controllers falling asleep? Well, this is like the entire agency falling asleep all at the same time. The Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill has been a point of contention between Republicans and Democrats, primarily over labor issues, for the better part of a decade. They've gone through something like 17 extensions, and now it felt like earlier this week the latest extension hit the floor of the U.S. House because everybody realized at the last minute, wait a second, the extension ends on Friday. So it's unlikely that they come to a deal. It's very likely that about 4,000 FAA employees won't be coming to work over the weekend.
So it's mainly operating to small communities.
That's right.
It's going to be affected right away.
The sticking point are these subsidies to flights, nonprofit flights to rural communities. Now, pretty much every senator has a rural community, and they want this money to go, these subsidies. But that's where the fight is, and we might have non-essential employees laid off as late as tonight.
Cheryl Gay-Stolberg, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. When we come back, we'll talk about why Elizabeth Warren is out. And welcome back to the Domestic Hour of our Friday News Roundup. This week with Reed Wilson. He's editor-in-chief of National Journal Hotline. Cheryl Gay-Stolberg of The New York Times. Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal. And to start us off on this segment, message posted on Facebook by Ruth. How very, very wrong and cowardly it is that Elizabeth Warren is not the head of the CFPB. She has the passion, the smarts, the moral verite that insists on her leadership, but the people in D.C. did not show the courage necessary. What do you think, Reed?
Well, Elizabeth Warren was bypassed as President Obama's head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, largely because of the political realities. She may have all those attributes. The one other thing she has is a lot of enemies on the Republican side. Republicans already are angry at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau because they say it doesn't have the protections and the sort of oversight from Congress that it needs to become a relevant agency. They're angry about that. They are especially angry at the fact that Elizabeth Warren was what is combative. She loves to fight with Congress.
She criticized the banks, and that's why they didn't want her in there, Naftali.
Yeah, she definitely became something of a lightning rod. But it's also true that conservatives and Republicans in general don't like the CFPB, and they don't like the Dodd-Frank bill. And they've already signed a letter, 44
Explain
Senate Republicans.
Explain what the Dodd-Frank bill would have done.
Well, this was the broad banking reform bill, but the centerpiece of it that attracted a lot of attention and criticism from Republicans was this bureau, which was a very strong, independent, some would say powerful bureau that could, you know, was supposed to make sure that we didn't have the sorts of wrongdoing that we had that led to the last crisis. But the argument Republicans are making is it's just too powerful and that its director would be a czar, wouldn't be subject to congressional oversight. And so they have, in fact, the House passed a bill yesterday that would dilute the power of that organization. So it's not clear to me that they're going to confirm anyone. It's true that Elizabeth Warren was a lightning rod, but it's not clear to me that anyone would be confirmed. They're sort of holding that position hostage until they get changes that they want in the structure of the CFP.
Is this the banking lobby at work?
Well, sure. I think we know that the banking lobby did not like the Dodd-Frank bill and has been working very, very hard to undo some of its provisions, not only the Consumer Protection Bureau, but other provisions, the so-called Volcker rule on too big to fail. So, you know, just because this bill passed, like the president's health care bill, it is hugely contentious here in Washington. And now we are seeing the fight over the implementation of it. Elizabeth Warren's being pushed aside as sort of the first line in the sand. But I think Naftali is absolutely right. The person that President Obama picked to head the agency, Richard Cordray, has no greater chance of being confirmed by the Senate than Elizabeth Warren did. And I think what the end game will be is the Republicans are just want to, you know, force changes in this agency or let it twist in the wind and not confirm anybody to give it a real leader until they can do
what
that.
What about an absentee
appointment might
right.
be the only way that that President Obama gets anybody.
And Congress threatened not to
right.
leave.
Right.
Exactly.
That's right. Some people thought the president would recess appoint Elizabeth Warren, and a lot of her admirers, and she has many admirers, wanted him to do that. And I suspect that liberals and supporters of Elizabeth Warren are frankly angry with President Obama at not nominating her to head the agency.
We have not seen the last of Elizabeth Warren, though. She has had conversations with a number of top Democratic senators. They're trying to get her to run against Senator Scott Brown in Massachusetts, where she lives and works at teaching at Harvard University. If she does that, if she decides to run against Brown, she'll have a tough fight. He's got a lot of money in the bank. He's very popular. He just released a new poll that has him leading every possible Democratic candidate. But she is one of those people who could develop a very wide national network of donors very quickly and compete with that. Democrats have been looking for somebody to take on Scott Brown, in a state that's probably going to give President Obama 60% of the vote coming up next year. If they get Elizabeth Warren, she's got a good chance of coming back to the Senate that would have rejected her.
All right. Here's another question about the budget deal. Would your guest comment on Senator Coburn's inclusion of reductions in congressional spending, namely staff, constituent mailing, staff travel allowance, etc., citing Congress budget increase of 55% in the last 10 years? Does the senator have a good point, and is there any chance, Naftali?
Well, first of all, Senator Coburn, I mean, we should just say he's a very conservative senator who has proposed a plan that would cut $9 trillion from the deficit in 10 years, much more than anybody else thinks possible. But he's been a very vigorous proponent of this, and he came out with a report just a few days ago sort of outlining the way he would do this. And he did emphasize the fact that one of the things that he would do is cut congressional expenditures, that is, expenditures of Congress on itself. It's not a huge amount of money, but I think it's very symbolic. And I think that's why he put it out there. And he talked about how Congress's budget has increased. You know, my sense is Congress probably, just like everybody else, you know, could cut some of its expenditures. That's obviously not where the answer to our financial problems lies, but it is a symbolic thing to do.
And it's not at all surprising, you know, when President Obama took office, he froze the salaries of federal employees, much to the consternation of a lot of people who worked for him. So I think Naftali is right. It is a symbolic measure. It's an attempt to tell voters, look, we're serious about this, and we're even including ourselves.
How did Minnesota finally solve its problems, Reid?
Well, Governor Mark Dayton, the Democratic governor, gave in to a lot of what the Republicans in the state legislature wanted, with a few conditions here and there. At the end of the day, though, it was the Republican bill that went through the legislature and was signed by Governor Dayton. The fact that so many licensing offices were closed in Minnesota meant that a lot of bars and restaurants were starting to run out of booze. They couldn't get their license, so they couldn't buy liquor and beer and wine. And when something like that starts to impact a population that just wants to go out and have a beer at the local bar, that's when pressure really steps up on some of these leaders.
Yeah, I mean we're seeing in a way microcosms of what's happening in Washington playing out in states across the country, and it's playing out a little bit differently because in some states Republicans are in control, in others Democratic, and in Minnesota there's a split government just as we have in Washington. But I think if there's a message here from Minnesota for D.C., it's just the disgust that people in Minnesota felt. I mean, I haven't been there, but by all accounts, people who were there, were very upset about this licensing provision, but they were upset in general about the fact that the government couldn't get its act together and that in starting on July 1st, the government essentially had a shutdown. And I think there really is a message for people in Congress that about the way people feel about what's going on and how it's being handled by lawmakers.
No, I think that's right. I was actually in Minnesota recently during the shutdown to report some stories on Michelle Bachmann, and it was, frankly, as a reporter, very frustrating. You'd called state offices for information and you'd get a recording saying, I'm sorry, I'm gone until further notice because of the government shutdown. All around the Capitol, the Capitol was closed. The public was not allowed into the Capitol, although lawmakers were inside working. But Governor Dayton actually had to have a press conference outside on the Capitol steps because reporters couldn't get inside. And you could feel the level of frustration among ordinary people in Minnesota.
And you mentioned Michelle Bachmann, who apparently suffers from migraine headaches. It's now become a political issue, I guess. How much does it matter, Reid, that in fact she has migraine headaches?
I don't think the migraines matter. I think what this story really tells us about Michelle Bachmann is that she is doing well in the polls and that there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who don't want her to do terribly well in the polls. This story was originally leaked out by ex-staffers of Bachmann.
Ex-staffers.
She has a lot of ex-staffers. She has gone through a number of spokespeople, a number of chiefs of staff, and a lot of them have been very outspoken about not wanting her to be the Republican nominee for president. Her former chief of staff was the Republican Party chairman in Minnesota, a guy named Ron Kerry. He's not been shy about saying Michelle Bachmann should not be the nominee. Just today, a prominent Republican named Fred Malik here in D.C. Has an editorial suggesting that Michelle Bachmann doesn't have the experience to be president. So there is sort of this organized effort to knock her down a few pegs when she is one of the three front runners. Two polls out this morning have Michelle Bachmann, Mitt Romney, and Rick Perry essentially at parity on the Republican presidential fight.
Sure.
Yeah, I might take slight issue with something Reid said about the migraines not mattering, because I do think it raises the issue of the health of our nominees. Being president and running for office is a very, very grueling process. And as anybody who has had migraines knows, they can be very difficult. They can really knock you flat.
Right.
Now, that is not to say that Michelle Bachmann would be incapacitated. I interviewed her son this week, who's a medical resident in psychiatry, and he's familiar with her experience. He says, she's absolutely capable of answering questions and of assessing information, et cetera. But the fact is that voters do have a right to know about the health of their candidates and whether or not they have any medical issues that could affect them. So I do think it's a legitimate issue for discussion. And separately, we are seeing a lot of discussion because there are a lot of migraine sufferers out there who know what it's like.
Natalie, we've heard, I don't know how accurate these reports are, that the headaches or stress-induced, she gets them every week. They can leave her incapacitated for days. Those are unconfirmed reports.
Yeah, they are unconfirmed reports, and so it's a little bit hard to make a judgment without knowing. I mean, reports also said that she at times has been hospitalized for days for them. So, there's a wide variety of reports. She, and I have to say, I was kind of impressed that her campaign reacted fairly quickly to this. And they put out a letter saying, you know, she takes medication. It doesn't incapacitate her at all. I think they realized this was a potential threat. And I think it's probably going to become clear in coming weeks exactly, you know, how serious this is. But it's inescapable that she has roiled this race. I mean, she sort of came out of nowhere. Mitt Romney was and is, I think, the front runner. But she, you know, filled a gap that perhaps people thought might be filled by Sarah Palin. And there's no question that in poll after poll, she is at the front runner's heels. And there are a lot of people in the party that are concerned about that.
Reed.
Michelle Bachmann is hands down the most interesting person in this race so far. There are a lot of unanswered questions about her that I think people are very interested in. I think the last time I was on your show, Diane, we talked a little bit about Bachmann and her the fact that everybody in Iowa knows that she has had 23 foster kids. It's that little detail that tells you that she's sort of percolating down into the Republican electorate. She's got a base in some states that's going to be pretty hard to shake. And yet, people don't know the history of her church. They don't know the history of her of this clinic that her husband runs. There are a lot of questions that profile writers around the country are going to have a lot of fun digging into.
Yeah, I've actually written several of those profiles about her. Her time as a foster mother, her church. I would say this: at bottom line, she is a person of deep Christian faith. This is who she is. This is really at her core, and she talks about it. She makes no bones about it. So her policies, her politics are deeply interwoven. Her decision to become a foster mother grew out of that. Her views on homosexuality, she rose in Minnesota as an opponent of same-sex marriage. All of this is interwoven with her faith, and that makes people on the right and the Republican Party happy. It makes a lot of liberals nervous.
Cheryl K. Stoberg, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about Rupert Murdoch and his son, who appeared before a parliamentary committee in London on Tuesday. Now, new questions being raised as to whether James Murdoch, the son, actually told the truth. Reed.
These questions are sort of perpetuating this scandal that I think has really grasped everybody to an extent that I think I was at least surprised by. Everybody in D.C. was watching the testimony. I can't remember the last time all three cable news networks broadcast a hearing of Congress, much less of the British Parliament. This is something that's really captured everybody's imagination.
You know, it's interesting, Neftali, the Wall Street Journal, which is a new News Corp paper, is reporting that the Justice Department is preparing subpoenas as part of a preliminary investigation into the company. So the question becomes, to what extent do you think the company here in the United States is going to be affected or infected by this whole imbroglio?
Well, it's true. I mean, I work for the Journal, which is a paper that is part of the News Corporation. I don't get any sense at the moment that it's affecting us in any way. There was a chief executive of Dow Jones who stepped down. But in terms of the sort of day-to-day operations of the paper and the way we go about our business, I haven't seen any change, nor would I necessarily expect any.
Cheryl.
You know, I think this is one of those stories that it's fascinating because we don't really know how it's going to play out. And it just seems to be growing and growing. It started with these revelations of phone hacking into the voicemail of a murdered girl in Britain. Journalists for the News Corporation, the now defunct News of the World, hacked into these phones. It's now embraced the Prime Minister of Britain. Executives of the News Corp have resigned. We're seeing this Justice Department investigation now. A whistleblower in Britain was found dead. Murdoch apologized and saying he's sorry in big newspaper ads. We're seeing reports now of Murdoch's financial contributions, including to President Obama. So it's just one of these webs that seems to keep growing. And I don't think we know where it's going to end up.
You know, it's interesting because there's been some criticism of the New York Times for taking on this story in such a big way.
There has been criticism of the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal wrote an editorial saying the schadenfreude was thick, and our columnist, Jonah Serra, said, well, it ought to be thick. I think these are difficult questions journalistically. When a newspaper is under attack, how do other newspapers respond? Certainly we at the New York Times had our own issues some years back with Jason Blair, and that was a very difficult time for us. He was a journalist who fabricated stories, and we were the subject of news coverage, and it was very, very uncomfortable. And so I feel for my colleagues at places like the Wall Street Journal. Naftali and I were just talking this morning, and I said, I feel for you, because, I can honestly say our colleagues here in Washington I can safely say that nobody is hacking into phones here, at least in this town.
And yet what seems to be happening is that the FBI is starting to look into whether victims of 9/11 phones were being hacked into.
Something that Rupert Murdoch said he had not seen evidence of, but of course I think that his word at the moment is probably not something the FBI is going to take.
Reed Wilson, he's editor-in-chief of National Journal Hotline. Short break, and when we come back, we'll open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, international news changes too rapidly to wait for the Sunday talk shows. Get insight and analysis from top journalists on the week's most important stories. The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. And it's time to open the phones first to Peter in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air.
I suggest a Democratic agreement with all Republican tax cuts, even for the largest corporations and biggest, richest taxpayers, but only if with their tax return they can submit a sworn declaration that all their investments are in the U.S. and agree to stiff penalties for lying. This could restore Keynesian economic growth in the U.S. rather than in Asia, killing the incentive to use tax reduction in order to move factories to Asia.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call, Naftali.
Well, that's not it's not a specific proposal I'd heard anyone raise now, raise so far. But it does bring up an issue that people are talking about, which is this idea of companies kind of relocating off-seas and transporting jobs overseas. And there are plenty of proposals in the context of tax reform for redoing the American tax structure to encourage investment here instead of overseas. I haven't heard it proposed exactly the way the caller did, but that is an idea that's being talked about.
And to Bruce, who's in Dallas, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling simply to lay this out there, though I don't think I heard you guys say it today. I've heard it in your program before, how both sides engage in the same kind of stuff in terms of vitriol. And I just want to point out this Debbie Wasserman Schultz incident, where she referred to, and for the life of me, I can't think of his name, her colleague from Florida, as, the gentleman isn't for the bill, unbelievable. And then his response was, you're the most vile, disgusting person in the Senate or the House, and, on and on and on. And to me, that is a microcosm of what's really been the problem in governing the country for a long time, because governing requires cooperation and negotiation. And when one side is going to act, as Cheryl said, behave like a teenager or young, it's not helping.
Naftali, you know all about this.
Well, the incident was largely, as the caller described, Alan West sent out, I think, an email, perhaps, that talked about her, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's the chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee and also a member of Congress, as being, I think, despicable. And he said, you're not a lady, and a few things like that. And that did get a lot of attention. And I think it does, to some degree, reflect the tone in Washington. I mean, it's not really an aberration. It perhaps stands out in the strength of the language that was used. But the fact is, every day on the floor of the House of Representatives, people get up and say pretty horrible things about each other and what they stand for. And the atmosphere is pretty bad. And I think that both causes and reflects a lot of what's going on and does make an agreement more difficult. And I also I have to say, I think a lot of people elected in the last election, came to Washington with an understanding that compromise was itself a bad thing. The idea that people had compromised too much, and it's not just a question of the strength of their beliefs, but the idea that compromising on them was a form of corruption and weakness. And I think that, too, is a cause of a lot of what's going on.
The problem with this whole Alan West, Debbie Wasserman Schultz incident, it really proves just how broken Washington is. Both sides now, the Democratic National Committee and Alan West's own campaign, are fundraising off this incident. They're fundraising off the fact that two members of Congress, who, by the way, happen to live in the same congressional district. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is Alan West's member of Congress. He represents a neighboring district. Two members of Congress are saying bad things about each other and then raising money off it. Just this morning on NPR, Morning Edition interviewed Mark Warner and Saxby Chambliss, two senators, and they both admitted that their leaders of their party are thinking about the election next year. They're already thinking about it in terms of this spending debate, this debt ceiling debate. That's the whole problem in D.C. There is never an off moment for an election.
I think we looked back on the 2008 election. President Obama came to town vowing to change the tone in Washington. And when you see an incident like this, and so many incidents like this, it is clear that he has not been able to change the tone. This becomes an issue for him, and I think it circles us back to why he and John Boehner are working together and why he is, in essence, throwing his own party under the bus by pursuing proposals that are making Democrats unhappy.
And here's an email from Warren in Arlington, Virginia, on that very point. He says, it just kills me to say this, having had such hope, but President Obama is turning out to be a huge disappointment. He's afraid to lose, afraid to lead, afraid to decide, afraid to speak out, just plain chicken. Even with the majority of public opinion on his side, America is going to get the government it deserves, even if it's the end of America.
Well, I know that a lot of people in the Democratic Party have that criticism of President Obama. They feel like he hasn't been a forceful spokesman, that he's been too willing to compromise, and that he's conceded points even before the negotiations begin. I do think in Washington you can't win. I mean, I think if he had come out more forcefully and aggressively, then he'd be being criticized for being far too partisan. And it's worth remembering that President Bush also came to Washington promising to change the tone. That was one of his big promises. Everybody said he failed. Now everybody says President Obama has failed. I think it's worth noting one big exception to all this, and that is this group called the Gang of Six over in the Senate, where you have three Republicans and three Democrats with a lot of people on both sides supporting them that have come out with a bipartisan, you couldn't really call it a plan because it's not detailed, but a framework. And they've said nice things about each other. They've worked together.
Who is in that Gang of Six?
Well, they don't like being called a gang, by the way. They don't like that term, but everybody calls them that. But on the Democratic side, you have Mark Warner, and then you have Dick Durbin and Kent Conrad. And on the Republican side, it's Saxby Chambliss, Mike Crapo, and Tom Coburn, who was temporarily out of the group, now back in it. But they recently came out with a big plan to cut the deficit. More than 30 senators have signed a letter more or less supporting them, members of both parties. And so it's this little kind of pocket of bipartisanship in an otherwise fairly partisan environment. But it has to be said that that plan was immediately attacked by both sides in very harsh terms. So on the one hand, it proves that bipartisanship can exist. On the other hand, it proves what happens to it when it sticks its head out of the ground.
Right.
In this whole deficit ceiling debate, there are these outside organizations that are playing this huge role that are attacking the Gang of Six proposal right off the bat. Whether it's the Democratic groups headed by former Vermont Governor Howard Dean and his organization that doesn't want any cuts to entitlement programs and is encouraging Democrats to stand up against any entitlement cuts. On the Republican side, it's groups like American Crossroads or Crossroads GPS that are running advertisements. There are other sort of more shadowy organizations that are just waiting for any kind of debt ceiling vote, and I've been told that they're already starting to plan. If any Republican votes in favor of a debt ceiling vote, they're going to get a primary challenge next year. So,
and that's thanks to Grover Norquist.
These are larger groups that aren't necessarily associated with Grover Norquist. They're sort of getting ready to make what is already a very conservative Republican conference even more conservative.
And in the midst of all this, President Obama is now backing the repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act. Does he now support same-sex marriage, Cheryl?
Well, this is a question I've spent a lot of time examining. Some people would say he was for same-sex marriage before he was against it. I think this is not a surprise. The president has always said that he objected to the Defense of Marriage Act, even as he himself did not advocate for same-sex marriages. He preferred civil unions. But it is one more step along this evolution. He keeps saying his views are evolving on the issue. So we saw him evolve toward instructing the Justice Department not to defend the Defense of Marriage Act in court. Now he is formally backing a legislation that would repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. Will he come out in favor of same-sex marriage before the 2012 election? I bet not. I think his advisors are just too worried it would inject a side issue into the election and roil the waters.
All right, let's go to Brighton, Michigan. Good morning, Frank. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I'm a retiree dependent mostly on Social Security, and I heard one of your panelists earlier say that Obama compromising on Social Security leaves Democrats running for Congress next year unable to run against the Republican approach to modifying Social Security and Medicare. And I just wanted to emphasize that as far as I've been able to gather, the two approaches are quite radically different. One adjusts COLAs, maybe does some means testing, stuff like that. And the Republicans, as evidenced by the Paul Ryan budget, basically want to do away with Social Security and Medicare. I just wanted to make that point for your panelists to respond to.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
The caller is quite correct. The approaches are radically different, but I think the fear among Democrats is that they will be conflated in the minds of the voters, and Democrats don't want to be connected with anything that smacks of cuts in these cherished programs, and they have argued very strongly that they are the party that would defend Social Security and Medicare. So just the idea that a plan would alter them makes Democrats nervous.
The AP is reporting that the Senate has rejected the House GOP plan to cut spending and require a balanced budget amendment. The vote was 51-46. Let's go to Indianapolis. Good morning, Amber. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I just want to call and say that during the week, I mean, you've had shows every week about this subject, and a lot of the times it's suggested that if we are to give the take away the tax breaks from the rich and the industries, that they'll somehow retaliate against us and try to tank the financial system of the America, and that kind of just really doesn't talk well about the rich and the industries. Are they really going to be that selfish, and I even say unpatriotic, as to do that to us? And also, has anybody taken a poll of the industries and the rich and find out how they feel about being taxed? And are the Republicans working for their constituents, or are they just kind of fighting with Obama?
That's interesting, Neftali.
Well, I hadn't heard the argument that they would intentionally tank the economy if their taxes were increased. I'd heard the argument on the Republican side that it would make it harder for them to create jobs and to invest in local and domestic industry. I mean, that's the argument that I've heard. I think there is a little bit of Republicans just wanting to oppose Obama, although I think it probably takes place in both parties. But there was an incident when Obama came out and very fervently embraced the Gang of Six approach. House Republicans were fairly open about the fact that that made them suspicious of the Gang of Six. His very endorsement of it made them question it, and they really weren't afraid to say that out loud. So I think there's just a great deal of distrust on both sides of the aisle.
I think that's right. I think, you know, we're seeing President Obama take a very aggressive stance in his messaging, his public appearances. He's had three press conferences in as many weeks. Today he'll have a town hall meeting in College Park, Maryland. He's really trying to take his message to the people. We saw an op-ed piece in today's USA Today. And he's got to be careful. He's got to walk a fine line, because if he does endorse something, it is the kiss of death for many in the Republican Party. So if he really wants to achieve something, he might actually have to hold back a little.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Columbia City, Indiana. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning. I just am reiterating what many people have said. The middle-class families in this country have been struggling since 2008, and they are losing ground. Most responsible families know it takes two things to make it work. They have to cut their expenses. Maybe they don't have cable anymore. Maybe the kids don't have dance lessons and karate lessons, many things of that nature. They also know that they have to bring in more revenue. Sometimes they work more hours. Sometimes they get second jobs, and they sell things. Around middle America, garage sales are intense. They're all over the place. People are selling cars, ATVs, motors, boats on their front lawns to make money. And yet our Congress cannot get it that it takes two things to make this situation right: cutting expenses and bringing in revenue. I think most middle-class Tea Party members would agree that people and companies that make more than $1 million a year are not sharing in the sacrifice, and they haven't really felt this recession to the degree that middle-class families have.
Thanks for calling, Linda Reed.
There is a sense around the country of distrust of I call it the pervasive pessimism. People are hurting significantly. This economic recovery has been so slow as to be almost not felt in a lot of places. The unemployment rate ticked back up in a number of states. A state like Nevada that was actually recovering just last month, their unemployment rate just ticked back up. So around the country, we're seeing a lot of people who are just depressed, upset, and they don't believe that they are handing handing off a better world to their children than the one they received.
One more point. John Edwards got some bad news yesterday. Naftali, he's got to return $2.3 million.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, this isn't really related to his broader problems. I mean, it has to do with an accounting error, and apparently it's not that unusual. On the other hand, you can't help feeling like nothing is going right for the guy, and that he is somebody who at one point was sort of a golden child of American politics, and he's fallen quite far, and so this is sort of a final blow that he has to return this money.
What about the possibility of an indictment, Cheryl?
Well, he was indicted last month on 6 felony charges for allegedly using more than $900,000 in campaign contributions to keep the woman he had gotten pregnant out of sight during the 2008 campaign. He says, you know, absolutely not. He did nothing wrong.
He hoped to use that money to pay his legal bills.
Right. So, you know, I guess we'll see how this plays out. Ultimately, I guess I think it's just very sad for John Edwards and his family. As we know, his wife Elizabeth died, and he's got these young children, and you know, the whole sorry business seems to me a sad affair.
There's a cadre of former Edwards staffers around the country who still keep in touch, and they are all quite saddened by this whole prospect. The fact that that they worked for a guy they believed in so much, who turned out to be so much different than what his public persona was. As for this FEC hearing, Naftali's exactly right. This is an accounting error. It happens with almost every presidential campaign that takes public matching funds. It's just a sort of a problem with the calculators.
Reed Wilson of National Journal, a hotline. Cheryl Gay Stoberg of the New York Times, Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you all so much. I'll be on vacation next week. My colleague Susan Page will be sitting in for me, back with you Monday after next. Thanks for listening, all. Have a great week. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Katie June Friesen answers the phones.